Hey, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this evening's event here at the LSE. My name is Jürgen Hake. I'm a faculty member of the International Relations Department, but I'm also the director of the Saucewey Hawk Southeast Asia Center at LSE, and it's that center which is organizing this evening's event. I'm very, very pleased indeed to be able to welcome Professor Jörn Dosch to the LSE today. Jörn is a professor of international politics and development at the University of Rostock in Germany. And prior to that, he was a professor of international relations at the Monash University Sunway campus in Malaysia. And before that, professor of Asia-Pacific studies at the University of Leeds. So he's been around, as you can see. Yeah, he was also a visiting professor at the LSE Saucewey Hawk Southeast Asia Center last year, primarily in the summer term. And we're very glad to be able to welcome him back tonight. Now, as you will all know, Vietnam has undergone phenomenal achievements, really, when it comes to its development. And the question to be addressed here tonight is as to how we make sense of this kind of success in developmental terms. How much credit really should go to the leadership in Hanoi that has adopted, promoted, I guess, ways to forward economic liberalization and focus on attracting foreign direct investment whilst maintaining party rule? How much credit should perhaps instead go to Vietnam's many bilateral and multilateral donors? As someone who has been a long-time observer of Vietnam and someone who has ample experience in the field of evaluating donor programs, Professor Dosch is extremely well-placed to answer this question for us. And I'm really happy that he's here. I would now actually ask you to put your phones on silent so that you won't be disrupting this event. It is being recorded. We envisage making available a podcast in future, subject to there being no technical difficulties. And as usual, obviously, we will have a Q&A after Jörn's talk. But for now, will you please welcome me in, sort of, will you join me in welcoming Professor Dosch to LSE to deliver his lecture entitled Who Developed Vietnam? The Role of International Donors.
Yeah, good evening, everyone. Thank you very much, Jürgen, for the very kind introduction. Thank you all for coming. It's quite an impressive audience in terms of numbers. There are not many places in Europe where you get such an excellent turnout for a talk on Vietnam, unfortunately, one has to say, but that's the reality. I would like to thank Jürgen and the Southeast Asia Center for inviting me and giving me the opportunity to share some of my findings, my current research with you. And this is also very much related to the 3 months I spent here in the spring as a visiting professor, which was extremely constructive and helpful and beneficial, because without that opportunity, I could not have done this kind of research. This is part of a slightly broader research project, which actually looks at the way that donors approach middle-income countries. And I've been looking at the cases of Vietnam and Thailand at the moment in particular. Also very interesting to compare the two cases, because Thailand is, of course, a bit further advanced in terms of its economic development, but then again we have an intervening variable, which is a military government. But the thing really is that when the idea of development cooperation started to take hold in the 1960s, very much related to the Cold War, of course, initially. But, I mean, the idea has always been the same in a way. There are donors, the industrialized nations, providing funds for developing nations. So at some point, with all our help, the developing nations will become industrialized nations. Then the job is done. In reality, it's not like that. It's not that easy. because we are now dealing with an increasing number of middle-income countries that are somewhere stuck in between. They are not fully industrialized nations, and there are certainly no developing countries anymore. So, and now the big question is that donors all over the world ask themselves, so how are we going to deal with these countries? Because from a European point of view, from a British point of view, from a German point of view, from a Swedish point of view, whatever nation you want to mention here, Vietnam, for example, is still a very important strategic partner. But now that Vietnam has achieved a per capita income of $2,000 a year, it's now a middle income country, and then from the viewpoint of many donors, it's not a country that should be supported anymore, because there are others which are more in need. For Denmark, for example, a case I have looked at in some detail, it's more the poorest African nations. There are always political reasons behind why countries support developing countries or not, right? So it's very much driven by political decisions. But this has led to big question marks all over the world, really. So what should be the approach towards middle-income countries? So they are not really entitled or should not be entitled to receive ODA in the traditional way, but still we would like to stay engaged in these countries. So how are we going to do that? So this is what my research is about. But a very essential part of this project is the question, so what have donors actually achieved? When you look at the literature on Vietnam's development, you read a lot about the government strategies, you read about the reform or reformation process Doi Moi since 1986 and how it has evolved, and what has been done, right, in terms of governance reforms, administrative reforms, infrastructure building, and so on. And so where does Vietnam stand today compared to 30 years ago? And then normally the verdict is very positive. Wow, Vietnam has achieved a lot. But despite the fact that Vietnam is one of the countries that has benefited most from ODA, it's one of the main recipients of ODA in the world, actually. No one, at least not in academia, has ever seriously asked the question, so what has come out of all this support? So what role has the government played in all that, and what role have donors played? Is the whole development process driven by the Vietnamese government, or is it more externally driven by donors? Well, we have these cases of externally donor-driven development processes in other countries. But in the case of Vietnam, the academic literature does not really cover that. And we have a lot of empirical evidence to be used. There are lots of evaluation reports, because every donor in the world evaluates or commissions evaluation to look really at the effects of development cooperation and the specific projects and programs in support of whatever water and sanitation in Vietnam or governance or human rights or you name it. Right? But so there is a gap in the academic literature, and I would like to bridge this more practical approach of evaluation, so what donors think they have achieved, which is, well, then presented in these evaluation reports, and the academic debate, which really for most parts ignores this rich body of documents produced by donors, by the European Commission, by DFID, by Danida, the Danish Development Agency, CEDA, the Swedish, and so on. So all these reports are actually in the public domain. They are easily accessible, yet they are not used, really. So this is the starting point. And to tell you more about the picture here, so I have lots of pictures from my last mission to Vietnam, which was last April. So not a lot of text on the slides, but many pictures for the background and the stories I'm going to tell. This is just
The board I found in one NGO in Ho Chi Minh City, which lists all the organizations that have provided for this, for just this one NGO, and which looks after street children and provides education to street children and shelters and so on. They have done brilliant work, really. But then you have about 50 organizations just supporting this NGO, of course, organizations which also support many other activities in Vietnam. But this actually already shows, given this one example of a relatively small NGO, how much dependent Vietnam is, ultimately, on external support, on ODA. So, I'm going to tell you very quickly what I'm going to do. So I will first tell you a bit about the development context and the achievements of Vietnam, then show you a few figures and graphs on the scope and the extent of the development cooperation, and also a few other data, just for the background to see what has been achieved in Vietnam and the money that has been spent as far as donors are concerned. And then I will talk about basically four, briefly, it's not enough time really to go into deep detail, but four case studies to actually answer the question, so what has the government achieved and what is the role of donors? So is it more the government, the regime, the state party apparatus that has driven the development, or is this all more or less externally driven? So first, coffee, very important for Vietnam's development. Second, water and sanitation, also very essential for development. I mean, if you want to, well, in very broad terms, develop a country, you have to make sure that actually the whole population has access to clean water. Then administrative reforms or governance in general, and finally human rights. Because in the current and really mainstream development cooperation discourse, no one really talks about building infrastructure anymore. Right? What we used to do, providing funds for factories or building bridges and roads and hospitals and schools. OECD donors don't really do that anymore. China does it. Japan does it. But not the OECD donors, when you look at DFID, for example. So most projects really are in the field of governance, because we all strongly believe that if the governance framework is right, everything else is also more or less right. So you need transparent decision-making, you need participatory decision-making, and you need to decentralize political power in order to provide a suitable framework for the national development process. So that's why the area of governance is very important here, and human rights, because that is for many donors significant importance in their relations with Vietnam. Again, also for political reasons, in the case of the Scandinavian countries, for example, where governments say, well, we help Vietnam to develop economically, but there is also a human rights problem in Vietnam, or at least we should contribute to the strengthening of human rights and adherence to human rights and creating a suitable framework for the implementation of human rights and so on. So, and then finally, I think we also need to talk very briefly about the elephant sitting in the room, which is China. Interestingly, when you talk to European donors, when you go to Brussels to talk to the people at DEFCO, the Development Cooperation Directorate, about the Commission's relations and role with Vietnam, and then ask about China, so people would normally look at you and say, well, it's China, okay, they do their own thing, but it's not an issue for you, for us. That is very interesting, because no matter whether you say, well, this is not traditional ODA, what China provides, China's role is so substantial, really, in Southeast Asia and many other parts of the world, in Africa and Latin America, that this can no longer be ignored and should also, I guess, be part of the development cooperation discourse to see if there is even cooperation with China possible. When we talk about China in the development cooperation, well, the argument you hear most often is, well, China undermines the efforts of OECD donors to promote democracy, good governance, and human rights. But, well, this is a very, very narrow view, actually. And then when it comes to the level of implementation, and when you talk to the stakeholders, to the European development agencies in Vietnam, they don't have any strong views about the role of China. And I find this very interesting. And so let's see if we can conclude here that we can simply ignore China or we should look at China in a bit more detail. So starting with a finding here from a conference, a government-sponsored conference that took place last year, where the government acknowledged that ODA had played a crucial role in turning Vietnam from a poor country into a low-middle-income country. And the government said, well, yes, without donors, we would not have been in the same position to reduce poverty and to enable the country to integrate deeper into the world economy and trade systems. But this review, actually, this was part of a review process of ODA in Vietnam and development cooperation. Again, one doesn't find anything about the specific results. It's the general acknowledgement that ODA has played a role, but again, nothing specific. So what role exactly? So where are the areas, where are the fields where ODA has really made a difference? And so how do government policy, government strategy and external funding come together? So is there actually sufficient country ownership, or do the donors who provide the funds also drive the agenda? These questions are not answered in these official reviews. One reason more to look at this in a bit more detail. So now, as for the first point, development process, and this is best measured, I think, not just in terms of per capita income or GDP per capita, but based on the Human Development Index, which is much more comprehensive than just GDP per capita, obviously. So here are just three indicators, and you can see that Vietnam's HDI in all areas really has improved significantly over the years since 1980. Of course, without comparison, I give you a few other countries in a second so that you get an idea of where Vietnam stands in relation to others. But it's quite an achievement when you compare this with the other countries to, well, for example, increase life expectancy by, well, almost 10 years, well, over a period of 34 years. And here you have the GDP per capita in PPP terms. I was just mentioning the figure of 2,000 US dollar per capita GDP, which makes a country a middle-income country. So that is nominal. But it's not, for whatever reason, not measured in PPP terms. So the usual figure that is taken is the nominal GDP per capita. And once a country reaches 2,000, then it's seen as a middle-income country. You also see that the HDI value has increased significantly. So obviously the higher the value, the higher the achievements in terms of human development. And again, very impressive development here since 1980 that not many countries in the world have actually achieved. So when you compare this to Indonesia and China, for example, from 1980 to 2014, you see here China and the red one is Vietnam, that, well, these three countries are more or less in the same group. China's development has been even more impressive than Vietnam's, but Vietnam does quite well. And when you compare then Vietnam to Thailand and the Philippines, you see here that Vietnam has basically the same HDI value like the Philippines, and also they're almost they are neighbors as far as the HDI rank is concerned. And this is, I think, quite remarkable because certainly 20 or 30 years ago, the Philippines were so much more advanced than Vietnam. And a few people back then, let's say in the mid-1980s or early 1990s, would have thought that Vietnam could actually achieve the level of the Philippines' development, which begs a lot of very difficult questions about the link between politics and the political system and development. Well, obviously, the Philippines is a democracy. We have some questions about some of the features of the Philippine political system, but it is a democracy. It's an old democracy in Southeast Asia with some interruptions. You know that I'm not going to the details here. But it's certainly much more democratic than Vietnam, right? Yet Vietnam, in relation to the Philippines, starting from a much, much lower level, has had the significantly more impressive development successes. Just for the average here, so Vietnam is actually already above the average of medium HDI group. That means, in general terms, that although Vietnam has just become a member of this exclusive club of middle-income countries, if you like, its HDI, human development, is already above the average of middle-income countries. So that also shows that human development does not necessarily correspond to GDP per capita. So, well, there are different ways of measuring development, the state of development, development achievements, and of course, human development is much more comprehensive. So just for comparison with the other ASEAN states, now we are talking about GDP per capita again, and you see here that Vietnam is still in the group of the, of course, poorer ASEAN members. There's still a significant gap to the next, which is the Philippines, right, which, despite the fact, again, showing that GDP per capita only has limited value when it comes to measuring development. But then Indonesia, well, there's still some gap here, and also when you compare to the ASEAN average. Now, just before I'm going to tell you a bit more about the development approach and the successes, just a few more figures here on ODA commitment to Vietnam. So over the years since between 1993 and 2014, the total ODA commitment to Vietnam amounted to about $90 billion. 60 billion was eventually dispersed. There's an issue with disbursement in Vietnam of ODA for reasons we can discuss a bit later if you like. So this leads to an average of about 3.5 billion per year, but you see there are significant differences. So it peaked in 2009. This was because Vietnam was quite heavily affected by the global economic crisis in 2008, 2009. And now it's been on the decline again, and you can already here see the effects of Vietnam entering now the group of middle-income countries, which has then motivated several countries to disengage from Vietnam and phase out their development cooperation. So the UK has already phased out, Denmark has, Sweden has, the Netherlands are in the process of doing so. Some other countries are there to stay for the time being. Germany, for example, no intentions whatsoever of moving out. And so then you have the donor countries which have a strong geostrategic interest, of course Japan as the biggest bilateral donor, and then Australia, for example, and also the United States. They are not phasing out. So Vietnam is one of the largest ODA recipients in the world, receiving support from over 50 bilateral and multilateral donors, and Vietnam has received ODAS grants, concessional loans, and a mix of the two. But about 75% of total ODA commitments have been loans. So you can see here the donors. These are figures for the period from 2000 to 2015. So these 15 years. You see here that by far, I mean, the most important is Japan. Right? And clearly there are geostrategic reasons here, because China is also there. So it's very important for Japan to stay engaged very prominently in Vietnam. And then you have the European countries, France, of course, as the former colonial power, Germany, the UK, with the shares of between 2% and 4%, and then the EU as well, 2%. If you add the contributions of all European donors up, then the EU, the Commission, and the EU member states actually then a major force when it comes to donor support to Vietnam. So here again you see grants, multilateral grants, bilateral, and multilateral loans. So to complete the picture. Right. So talking in general about the development achievements and the policy frameworks, the political strategies behind that, as you all know, the first far-reaching reforms after a long period of really crisis after reunification in 1975, crisis during the 1970s and 1980s, which were, of course, directly related to the severe damage caused by war, political weakness, and a very difficult international environment for Vietnam. The government launched the well-known political and economic reform process, Doi Moi, in 1986, which has been based on three main elements. First, shifting from a planned centralized economy based on public ownership to a multi-sector economy based on the market. Second, building a state based on the rule of law. And third, strengthening external cooperation with other countries. And so if you consider the second pillar here, building a state based on the rule of law, you can already see that the governance aspect is very important here, and this is also why many donors have supported Vietnam in this area of governance and rule of law and so on, because it's an official government strategy to strengthen this area. And these reforms have transformed the country from one of the poorest in the world, with a per capita income of around just $100 in the mid-1980s, to, as you already know, lower middle income status, with a per capita income of over $2,000 by the end of 2015. So Vietnam's economic growth rate averaged 6.4% per year in the 2000s, but began to slow in the wake of the global financial and economic crisis in 2008-2009. It has picked up since then, and Vietnam has managed to improve its macroeconomic stability and so on. So there are many government strategies that have provided the framework for this reform process. The current socio-economic development strategy, which started in 2011 and runs until 2020, gives particular attention to structural reforms, environmental sustainability, social equity, and emerging issues of macroeconomic stability. And this overarching development strategy defines three so-called breakthrough areas: promoting human resources and skills development, improving market institutions, and third, infrastructure development. The preceding five-year socio-economic development plan, which is actually part of the overall strategy, had a focus on higher quality and more sustainable economic growth, improved living standards of ethnic minority populations, strengthened environmental protection and mitigation, and prevention of the adverse impacts of climate change. So when it now comes to, so that's very, very briefly the framework. So there are actually, and all donors basically confirm that the policy framework is quite good, right? So the needs are comprehensively identified. The strategies are in place. In other words, the government knows what it is doing or what it has to do to achieve a higher level of development for Vietnam. So the plans are correct. That would, if you interview donor, most would say that. There are no major issues with the plans, but how to implement them, that's another issue. But before we come to this question, I should mention here that indicator of Vietnam's impressive development process is not just the, which is of course related, but not just the HDI figures, but also the fact that Vietnam has been one of only a few countries in the world that basically achieved all of their MDG goals, the Millennium Development Goals, and according to the evaluation and the report that was conducted by the United Nations towards the end of the MDG period, which ended, of course, in 2015, Vietnam completed several MDGs and targets, such as eradicating extreme poverty and hunger, achieving universal primary education, promoting gender equality in education. And it has also achieved several health-related indicators, such as reducing the maternal mortality ratio and the child mortality ratio, and the other objectives that were achieved, for example, the target for malaria and tuberculosis control, as well as combating HIV/AIDS, where MDGs were not fully achieved by 2015. Vietnam is on a good path of achieving them very soon. And then to conclude this short part, when one is using the official indicator for absolute poverty, which is the which is 1.9 US dollars in PPP terms in 2011. So this is absolute poverty. If you have less than $1.90 per day in PPP terms, then you live in absolute poverty, extreme poverty. And if we take this indicator as the bottom line, then the fraction of people living in extreme poverty dropped from over 50% in the early 1990s to 3% today. But not all that, it's not all good news, of course. You can find flaws in the system. And when you look a bit deeper, you find that ethnic minority groups have fared less well across the MDGs, along with the landless and poor urban migrants. There are also still significant gaps between urban and rural residents, and between regions of the country, with the northern mountains, central highlands, and central coastal regions all faring less well. There are also major challenges. In the past few years, for example, Vietnam has done less well in terms of translating economic gains into health and educational improvements. And the rise in income has been higher than the rise in the HDI indicators in the past few years. And there are also many issues related to population that has reduced the resilience of ecosystem services, particularly the country's extensive marine environments. So you have seen that with the last spring when saltwater intrusion went 70 kilometers up the Mekong. Well, when the salt water contaminated a lot of the Mekong Delta, so you had there has an impact on shrimps, for example, shrimp production, because shrimp can. I'm not an expert on that, so but I actually visited some communities which depend on shrimp farming, and there the shrimp simply died because they cannot sustain this level of salt water, right? If for humans that doesn't matter that much, but for these very vulnerable animals, it's very easy for them really to die when the level of salt in the water increases by just a small fraction. That's a serious problem that has affected hundreds and hundreds of farmers, thousands of farmers actually in the Mekong Delta last spring. When you look at evaluation reports and their headline findings on the contribution that, for example, the UK made to the development of Vietnam, or the EU's contribution, or Denmark's contribution, again, you would like to see sometimes some harder evidence, maybe, but it's very mixed. That's very typical from this very recent report, which evaluated the long-term development cooperation between the UK and Vietnam. So they usually start with the statements like, evidence of whether the UK's development assistance has contributed to an enabling environment for sustainable poverty reduction in Vietnam is somewhat mixed. Yes, there is some contribution, but we are not so sure, really. And these consultants are very well paid to actually come to conclusive findings. And to be honest, and I have to be fair, this report is very detailed. And then when you go through the very long report, which is, again, public, you find actually a lot of evidence for UK contribution. But when you try to sum it up and when you try to come to an overall conclusion, of course, it's always very difficult to say, well, this is exactly what the UK has achieved. And one of the reasons why this is so difficult is, of course, because you have so many other donors which are also active in the same areas. So in many cases, you have multi-donor projects, like in the area I'm talking about in the second, water and sanitation. No, first coffee, but then water and sanitation. So you have several donors involved. So you cannot tell it apart in the end and say, well, this was, if there was a major program, multi-millions, in some cases more than 100 million project, which was funded by the UK, by Sweden, by the EU, by Denmark, by Australia. You cannot say, well, this was the specific UK contribution. And that's a dilemma for consultants. I'm also very often facing this challenge, because if you evaluate for the German Ministry for Economic Cooperation and Development, they want to know exactly what they have achieved in Vietnam or what they have achieved in Thailand. But it's impossible to tell, and then they are very disappointed, of course. So my question rather is, I'm not going to the details of individual donors. My question is, what difference has ODA overall made, not specific donors? So, and that is, I'm not going to the details here, but just to show you how development cooperation is conceptualized. So when you conduct an evaluation Actually, still confidential because the report has not been approved even yet. But so you saw it first here, right? This is an attempt to reconstruct actually what Denmark wanted to achieve in Vietnam. The thing is that donors do not, they have an idea, they produce strategies. They say, well, this is what we want to achieve, but they don't do it over a longer period of time. And then when you look over 15 years, so you need to try to find out, first of all, so what did they actually want to achieve? So you take all the different strategies that have emerged over the years, that have been made public by the donor. In some cases, these are also confidential documents, but program strategies, projects, and so on. And you put it all together. And then you try to identify the outputs, the outcomes, the results, and the impact, and then the overall goal of all donors, of all development cooperation, is always poverty reduction. Right? But then you have these, you first need to have these logical frameworks, these intervention logics, because this is the baseline. You need to have a framework. And then you can decide, okay, they have actually achieved this and that, but first you need to know, obviously, what did they want to achieve? And one of my criticisms has always been, well, donors should actually do that themselves. They should have long-term thinking, and if they should be absolutely sure about what they want to achieve. But, you know, I mean, development cooperation is very often driven by short-term interests as well, and also donor interests. And so if you really want to know over a longer period of time what a specific donor wanted to achieve in the country, you have to do the work yourself and try to reconstruct the intervention logic. I show you a second one, which is already public, which has been published, which is from the evaluation of the EU support to Vietnam. And very similar, it's presented a different way, but you always have the results, you have the impacts, and you have a global impact again, and then you have poverty reduction. So, but what I wanted to show here as well is that different roads can lead to poverty reduction. So it would take hours and hours and hours to study all these intervention logic. I just wanted to show you how this is actually done and how one actually starts when we look at the donor support. We start at the strategic level and try to find out what the specific donor actually wanted to support and what they wanted to achieve. Okay, the first case study is coffee. Coffee is a relatively new agricultural product to Vietnam. It did not... This is wrong, actually. It was introduced not in 1957. It was introduced in 1857. Sorry about that. A bit earlier than that. 1857, during the French colonial regime, which was over by that year, of course, 1957. Spot the mistake. But it was not important. Right? It was nothing that... provided strong input to the economy overall. Then there was a shift towards plantations in the early 20th century, but at a very, very small level still. Compared to Latin America, for example, coffee was not important in Vietnam. Then the whole production was interrupted by the Vietnam War. And then came the Doi Moi reform process and came the privatization process. And this really provided the push for a substantial increase in production, particularly in Dak Lak, in the Highland province. And then in just a few years, but not a very long period, from the mid-1980s, when the liberalization process started and new coffee companies emerged coffee became attractive as an export product for these new companies. Then from the mid-1980s till the late 1990s, Vietnam became the second largest producer of coffee in the world. So the increase before the Doi Moi reform was just 0.1%, and then it's today it's 20%. So Vietnam has a share of 20% of the global coffee production. This has to do, of course, with the quality of the soil. So the soil in the highlands is particularly suitable for coffee plants, particularly for the Robusta kind of coffee bean, which is not the highest quality, but it's the most popular one, the one that is used for basically the coffee we drink, not for the gourmet coffee, but everyday coffee, right? That's Robusta coffee bean. So coffee is one of the sectors that has contributed most decisively to poverty reduction in Vietnam, because some 2.6 million people are employed in the coffee industry, and according to all studies that are available, the coffee sector has significantly contributed to poverty reduction. There are also downsides: deforestation, over-fertilization, and of course global overproduction, because Vietnam's gain is the loss of Latin American coffee producers mainly, and the fact that coffee is very cheap for us is related to that overproduction and the fact that Vietnam entered the market. But this is not our topic for today, right? So, in a way, fortunately, we can ignore these side effects. We cannot ignore them in general, but for the purpose of this presentation, it is quite clear that it was the government that set the framework, that the liberalization process, the privatization process, made this success story possible. There was not much donor involvement here. Of course, you need your international contacts, you need your export markets, and most of the coffee is, of course, exported to Europe, the United States, and Korea. But there was no role really played by development cooperation. Maybe some technical advice here and there. So Germany provided some advice and consulting on organic coffee production, small projects really. So here you have a sector which contributed significantly to poverty reduction, which was not externally driven at all. Right. So via, of course, commercial contacts and markets, of course, but not through development cooperation. But it looks quite different when we look at the when we come to the sector of water and sanitation. As I said before, water and sanitation, access to clean and hygienic water is of course a very crucial part of national development. The early 2000s, I try to find the exact year, but I think it was 2001 that Vietnam came up with a national target program for rural water supply and sanitation, because this was one of really the weak points of the development process. At that point, that only a small percentage of the rural population had access to clean and hygienic water and sanitation. Now, I mean, this was also a Millennium Development Goal. By the end of 2015, more than 85% of the rural population had access to hygienic water, and 45% had access to clean water. So there's a difference. Hygienic water is water that you can basically use, but you cannot drink it really, and clean water is drinkable. We don't have to bother about the differences, but the vast majority of the rural population has now access to hygienic water, and in the case of schools and hospitals and clinics, 90% have access to hygienic water and hygienic sanitation systems. In this case, The government provided the framework. They provided the targets. They said, I mean, this is what we want to achieve. The targets were even slightly exceeded. So it all went quite well. But the Vietnamese government never had the funds to achieve that. So the plan was there, the National Target Program for Rural Water Supply and Sanitation, and then also a National Rural Water Supply and Sanitation Strategy. But Vietnam here really depended on foreign donors to provide the funds to implement this program. So the contribution of the Vietnamese government actually was quite small. The lion's share was provided by Australia, UK, Denmark, the Netherlands, and some other donors, but these were the main donors. The World Bank, by the way, provided support for water and sanitation urban areas. So it was divided, division of labor among the donors. World Bank concentrated on the urban population, and other donors like the UK and Australia and Denmark, the Netherlands, they provided the funding for rural water. In this case, one can clearly say, well, the agenda was not driven by donors, because the donors did not provide the plan. It was the government which provided the plan and the strategy for that, but then external funding was essential. Otherwise, it would not have happened. And now we have a problem now that many donors have been phasing out, which have been active in this area, like the UK, like Denmark, like the Netherlands. So there is basically no support anymore, very limited support for water and sanitation. Well, not all parts of the population have access. There are still many parts of the countries which are not connected to the system. But now, it's not just about providing the money for the pipes, right? It's also about maintaining the system, which is very expensive, of course. And there is a great urgency to finance and maintain all the services that have now been provided, right? And here, suddenly, there are no funds available because the government is not in the position to provide these funds, not at the scale that it would be needed. So actually the estimated cost is about 8.3 billion per year to just maintain the systems. There are also studies which suggest that the country loses around 1.3% of its GDP due to costs associated with sanitation and human health issues. So here we see the whole dilemma, right? So actually it worked quite well as far as the implementation of the plan was concerned. Government having a high level of ownership of the whole process, then donors come in, provide the funding, install everything, and then they go away and nothing happens. There's a big problem now for Vietnam because without further donor support, there are big questions of how the system can be maintained. For governance, it's all a little bit easier because you're not really talking about material structures, at least not in most of the cases. So there has been very strong support for the National Assembly in Vietnam. So I conducted many interviews with actors, stakeholders at the National Assembly. And, of course, donors always say when you ask the donor, oh, yes, we helped to strengthen the National Assembly. So today the National Assembly, the parliament of Vietnam, plays a much more prominent role than before. It's not a rubber stamp of the Politburo anymore. It's true. Well, also very interesting to compare it to China, for example. But in the case of the National Assembly of Vietnam, the National Assembly has indeed been quite proactive in recent years. So not all government policies were accepted. There have been heated debates. And there has been certainly a professionalization in the lawmaking process. So in many regards, the National Assembly as an institution has been professionalized, has been strengthened as far as legal frameworks are concerned, as far as simply capacities of members of the members of the National Assembly are concerned, as far as the procedures are concerned, all that, where you had from several donors, including the UK, including Denmark, Sweden, the European Union, there was support for that. And it's not like in the case of water and sanitation, where you can say, well, 85% of the population are now connected to clean or hygienic water. In the case of something institution like the National Assembly, you cannot say, well, the quality of the lawmaking process has improved by 30% or something like that. That's not possible. But I think there is, it's credible to say that many of the procedures, the institutional capacities and the individual capabilities have been strengthened due to donor support. For example, in 2013, the National Assembly held unprecedented confidence votes for almost 50 most senior government and state officials, which created a lot of publicity, actually. And it's quite unusual for a one-party system to do that. Then I have many more examples on governance, but I'm running out of time already. As always, time flies when you're having fun. I just wanted to mention the example of the support to the administrative reform. Like with water and sanitation, it all starts with a big government strategy, right, which runs over many years. And in this case, it's the public administration reform process, which was initiated a few years ago to overhaul basically the entire administrative system at the national and at the provincial level. So there are many elements to that, but one interesting element is the one these administrative offices, one-stop shops, which have now been established in many provinces. We know this from Europe, in the UK and in Germany and many other places. If you need a permit, if you need a driving license, if you need a passport — a passport is different in the UK, I know — but for a business license, well, in 20 years ago, 30 years ago, you would go to different offices. Now you normally have it in one place. And also the number of steps of administrative and approval procedures have been approved. I remember when I was a child in Germany and a younger man, it could take a long time really to get a license or a permit for whatever, because you had to go to different offices. Now this is all streamlined. And now, based on our European experiences, so Germany, Denmark, Sweden, again, the usual suspects, have started to introduce the same systems in Vietnam. And here you have a case which is more donor-driven than others, because the Vietnamese themselves, they did not think a lot about streamlining the administration in that way. But here the concepts were actually developed together with the Vietnamese authorities, and now you have these one-stop shops where you can get almost everything — licenses, certifications, permits — involving previously different offices, and now you have a single desk providing client-oriented services. In one case, in the northern province of Lao Cai, getting a construction license, for example, would take 7 months just a few years ago, and it now takes a maximum of 20 days. And there's also a regular monitoring of the customer service. There are customer service surveys. And so the whole administrative procedures have not only become more simplified and more effective, but also more transparent. And here in this one-stop office, and most actually, you have a list of the department heads with their mobile phone numbers. So you can actually, as a customer, if you're not happy about the service, or you have a question which the gentleman or lady there at the counter cannot answer, you can call this person directly. Actually ask several times of how many people actually call this person. They all told me there in this one-stop office, oh yes, they are called very regularly, but I didn't get any figures on that. But the fact that the numbers are here and that the phone numbers are here shows that at least they want to make the system transparent. At the same time, they're very closely monitoring the performance of the service personnel here. So this is actually a chart here which shows customer satisfaction with a specific member of staff here, according to the customer survey. And there is no data protection or whatever. So they just put the charts on the screen for everyone who wants to see them. So, yeah, well, this is a specific, there's the name of the employee, and so you get all the data. So there can also, they have also cameras everywhere there, and they can monitor exactly what is going on there. What would be interesting now is, has it reduced corruption? And I cannot answer this question because there are no studies on that yet. Because the whole idea of the administrative reform process, of course, was not just to make the administration more efficient and effective, but also to reduce corruption, because corruption is considered to be one of the pressing issues, the major issues that also, in a way, can potentially, over the longer term, undermine the legitimacy of the Communist Party. Okay, last example on human rights. So this is, again, a very interesting area where the government was initially reluctant to accept any donor support. Right? You know how difficult it was in Vietnam to talk about human rights. The climate has changed. It's much more easier to do that. And this is mainly the result of donor involvement. So as I said before, that at least as part of their ODA package, many donors wanted also to do something in support of human rights, just also to increase legitimacy of ODA to Vietnam. It's a bit like China. Each prime minister, each president who travels from the West, who travels to China, has to talk about human rights at some point, has to mention human rights. And it seems to me that many donors wanted to do at least a small project on human rights, in addition to strengthening small and medium-sized companies or providing support to the water sector or other technical areas. And so there have been several projects on human rights, and one that is particularly interesting is one that was funded over many years by Denmark, Sweden, and the European Union. And this actually led to the establishment of human rights departments at law schools and law universities. These are pictures from the law university in Ho Chi Minh City. So something that was completely unknown before, doing a master degree or PhD on a topic related to human rights is now very popular. So this was a roundtable discussion we had there at this was not the Vietnam National University, that was the Ho Chi Minh Law University, but at the Vietnam National University, which they also have a human rights center, between 20% and 30% of all master dissertations and PhD theses have focused on human rights in the past few years. So there's a growing interest in human rights issues. In addition, dozens of new textbooks on human rights have been written and published. There are now professors and lecturers specializing in human rights. And all this has mainly been donor-funded, because not much funding has been provided by the government, because it's still not really in the interest of the government to fund activities in these areas, just because, not because they are shying away from the discourse, but I think because there is a concern that these ideas could grow and transform into something different. Because at the moment, when you look at the specific courses and what is actually taught at these centers, it's still at a very general level, right? What are human rights? Why is it important? But it's not so much about the situation in Vietnam yet. But it's a good start. And also what is really interesting is that many of these professors and more senior professors who work at these centers, at these initially donor-funded centers, then contributed to the amendment of the Constitution, because the Constitution was amended in 2013 and introduced new provisions on human rights. And there are now a total of 36 articles in the Constitution that deal with human rights. Well, to preempt any questions on that, yes, it's not going very far, and most observers say, well, it's just a token commitment to human rights, but it's in there. That's important. It's in there, and it's a process, of course. And you can say that all that, there is probably the most, we had coffee, which had no donor involvement whatsoever, basically. We had water and sanitation, which had strong, high level of government ownership, but was mainly financed by donors. You had governance, the administrative reforms, which was a good mix, really, of donors and Vietnamese stakeholders coming together to formulate the plans and implementing them together. And then you have now at the other extreme, coffee being the one, human rights the other, an area which is almost entirely driven by donors. Yeah, so, but now again, there's the question of sustainability. What happens to these centers now? Because the donors that funded these centers, mainly Denmark and Sweden, have now phased out. There's no support anymore. These centers are now required to sustain themselves. They have built a lot of international networks with other universities in the region, with Europe. And so they are very active in applying for EU grants, for example. But it's a different situation for them. So they don't get any direct support now. So it's unclear what happens to the libraries, for example, to all the facilities that have been established. Right. So I don't think we have really time to talk about China a lot. This is just to say that this is in Lao Cai, the border between Vietnam here and China there. Here, I don't know whether you can see that. That's the Vietnamese side from where I took the picture, and there you can see China. This is Yunnan province on the other side. So there is, of course, very regular traffic going on. So many Vietnamese work in China, so they get a day permit, they go to China to work there, and they go back in the evening. But overall, China has become, well, the most important external funding source for infrastructure development in Vietnam, from hydropower to railways and roads and so on. Japan is still very active. But most of the funding for infrastructure is now provided by China, and this is, well, as far as we know, going to continue, also within the context of the One Belt, One Road initiative, the New Silk Road initiative, from which, if all goes according to plan, Vietnam will greatly benefit, like many other Southeast Asian countries. But again, this begs important questions about relations between Vietnam and China. You know, there's no unified position within the political elite of Vietnam as to how to deal with China. There are those, I mean, the elite is basically split into those who perceive China as the closest ally and want to intensify relations between the communist parties and those who see China as the rival. And of course, we know about the troubles in the South China Sea and so on. So it's not very easy. So I don't really think that the Vietnamese government has a very clear strategy of how far it actually wants to go in terms of accepting all that support from China. Conclusions. These are pictures from the shrimp farming communities, by the way. So we all got these caps for corporate identity. The local fisheries office provided us with these caps before the local mission there. So we talked to these farmers, and as I said before, they all lost their shrimp due to the saltwater intrusion. That's the Mekong, or one of the branches of the Mekong. And here also you see, of course, the downside of being too much dependent on donors, because in many cases where you do not have strong government ownership, then donors come with certain concepts. In this case, they convinced entire communities to switch to certain type of shrimp. Again, I'm talking about things I do not know much about, but it's a serious problem because they were praised as being particularly resistant, and the farmers were promised to achieve higher prices for these type of shrimp, but in the end it didn't pay off because they lost all of them, because what donors, in this particular case it was Denmark again, didn't factor in was that that there could be such a severe saltwater intrusion at some point. But that is just the background for the conclusions here. So what I wanted to show here is that development is never entirely, common sense almost, is never entirely donor-driven, of course, at least not in the case of Vietnam. I think I could clearly show that it's not donors who developed Vietnam. So at the beginning was a very clear government strategy which has worked quite well, not in all parts. I mean, privatization of state-owned companies has not progressed as far as it was initially hoped and all that. There are still inequalities. Sure, there are challenges. But overall, Doi Moi and the related strategies have worked well. So in most areas, donors have, in a quite targeted way, provided funds which were aligned, or funding which was aligned with these government strategies. So there are very few instances, human rights was one, when an agenda was directly pushed by donors. So in most cases, it was really more of a partnership where the government retained ownership of the process and donors came in to provide the funds. But now the big question is what happens next, because that was not factored in. So not much strategic, as far as I can tell, not much strategic thinking on the part of the government has gone into a scenario when there is no substantial donor funding available anymore, because the assumption has been this is going to continue for a very long time. So the fact that they now have to somehow look after their water supply systems themselves and provide the funding for that has taken them by surprise to some extent. So if there is one shortcoming of in all this, is that not much thought has gone into phasing out and exit strategies. And this is how I would like to conclude, and thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Jörn. That's really fascinating material. We still have about 20 minutes or so for questions. Who would like to start us off? There's someone there sort of in the middle, yes?
Can you elaborate a little bit more on when you say that the government is not the government doesn't want to support studies of human rights? I mean, considering their past, wouldn't they be more inclined to support the study of human rights?
Yeah, good point. What I've seen is that there is no resistance anymore. I mean, you can more or less openly talk about this without having to be concerned about consequences. You can talk about it at an academic level. You can talk about human rights at a university center or university department. My impression was that the government is really not too keen, and this is what I've heard at these centers, at these universities in Hanoi and Ho Chi Minh City in particular, that so far they had not received any indication from the government that funding would be provided for these centers. So I don't know really, but there is no, that's the bottom line, really. There is no strong encouragement by the government to do all that. But it's not blocked anymore. It's, you can do it. So it's accepted. I think that's a step forward. But, also, given the constitutional amendments, there is a much open discourse about human rights in society. But there are still limits. I wouldn't say that's an open discourse. That's certainly not the case. There are still very clear limits of what you can do and what you can't do, right?
All right. There's a question sort of at the back there. Yes.
Yeah, my first question is on the role of the state. Mm. You don't have to, you haven't been so specific about how the coffee sector actually has been developed. So was that more of a random trial and error, and then they were lucky because the soils had a great quality, or was it a state-driven process in which the state actually somewhat singled out certain sectors that they were considered of a high growth potential? And the second part would be, you said at the beginning HDI was expanded. Mm. So what role did the government play in actually expanding education and health? Mm. And if you could compare that, if you know about something about this, to the Indian process and...
I can't compare it to India, but so yes, I mean that has been one of the priorities of the government. I mean the strategies were always directed towards that, increasing access to health and education. That's been a long-term process. It was first provided, of course, in urban areas. It took a long time before basic infrastructure in health and education was also provided to some of the more remote provinces, like the highland provinces. But the situation has, again, improved. It has certainly improved. I don't have really comparisons, so I don't know how, let's say, Dark Luck looked like 20 years ago. I don't know that. But again, I mean, it's like with water and sanitation. Vietnam needed the support of donors, which were very happy to provide that support, because there's nothing wrong with increasing access to health and education. So this, again, worked quite well. With the coffee, these were mainly private companies developing that. It was already clear before that the soil was good and all that. There was good potential for coffee in Vietnam. So there were then emerging private companies. You have very big companies now, like Highlands Coffee, for example. Multi-million, don't know, maybe billion dollar enterprises, which seized the opportunity once the liberalization process started and private ownership was possible. So coffee companies in the private sector, that were actually the first success stories of the Doi Moi process. Because also there was no competition from state-owned enterprises. So private companies did not compete with the state-owned enterprises in this regard. So you basically only have private companies there. So, and it's not a level playing field today. State-owned companies still enjoy greater benefits, it's sometimes difficult for private companies to survive. And so also the whole legal setting, the policy setting is still very much in favor of state-owned companies. But it worked well in the coffee sector.
Okay, I will collect a few questions, maybe three or four. So if we start with the gentleman here at the front. Yes.
Yes. So according to your presentation, it was pretty interesting to see the interest of the government and the donors. Mm. You were saying also about investing in governance and decentralization. I would like to know to what extent people and business were involved in the decision-making of this development program.
Okay, thank you. So there was a question on this side of the room. I think the lady here just next to
I'm interested to know what role and how significant has the overseas Vietnamese community played in Vietnam's development after the war?
Okay, and then we'll take another one, sort of the lady just sitting over there, yes?
Yeah, I remember you said that you think most of the development organizations should place a better focus on longer-term thinking and strategies. Mm-hmm. The way I see it, there have been a lot of organizations that emerge out of, you know, very short-term needs of the people and of the community.
Mm-hmm.
And so what do you think on that? Like how should the organization?
Okay. So more questions?
Okay,
so
no, we'll take those three and then we'll have another round, yeah?
There is, well, good point. There's not much of a public involvement in decision-making processes. Officially, such mechanisms exist, and there are more opportunities now, but it's still very limited. It's still very much a closed system, right? So when I went to the provinces and talked with the local party heads in the cities and provinces, and the division heads for, let's say, water, and asked them, so what did they think about the phasing out of donor support? What would happen to the systems? They didn't know that because it had not been communicated by Hanoi. So it was also very clear, and many told me, well, even at the local political level, stakeholders were not involved in formulating, drafting these strategies. So it's still a very centralized system where decisions are made in Hanoi and then communicated down to the provinces. So the overseas community, that's, I don't know. I'm sorry, I really don't know. I haven't seen any studies on that. I've never even come across this issue. That's a good point. I mean, more research needs to be done, but unfortunately, at the moment, I can't give you an answer to that. But in general terms, it doesn't seem to me that private initiatives play a big role. Also, unlike in the Philippines or in the Central Asian state like Tajikistan or Kyrgyzstan, where the economies very much depend or are strongly supported by remittances, that doesn't play a big role in Vietnam, it seems to me. But I'm walking on thin ice here. I don't know. I don't know the answer. Long-term strategic thinking. Yeah, that's also, if you think just in long-term, you could miss, well, the rising needs and you lose your flexibility. I was making this point more from the perspective of donors, which often change their strategies in response to what they perceive as political challenges. I give you one example. I don't know what I used to live in the UK, but I haven't really followed the discourse here at the moment. But I know in the case of Germany, basically the absolute lion's share, most of development cooperation will now be targeted to migration issues, basically to prevent migration. That is now the overarching objective of development cooperation. So forget about all the other objectives that existed before. So they have all the German development agencies, the ministries, and so on. They have received clear instructions to refocus all their programs towards the migration complex, right? And this is what I mean. So there are political dynamics, of course, but it's not good to lose sight of other needs and long-term developments. So just because we have some kind of a migration issue we have to deal with doesn't mean that all the other problems are solved, right? So that's why I would like to see maybe a long-term framework that is flexible enough to incorporate emerging developments, of course, but there should be a long-term commitment to certain issues. Well, we have this with the sustainable development goals to some extent, but again, it seems to me that the relevant stakeholders in Germany don't think a lot about sustainable development goals at the moment because they are so much focused on migration.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We still have time to collect a few more questions. Sort of this gentleman sort of towards the left. Yeah.
Thank you very much for your presentation. At the end of your presentation, you mentioned that the ending of the fund for water and sanitation by international donor has been like seen with like somewhat surprise by the state. So I'm just wondering, like, has there any attempt to intensify the tax collection, capability and redistribute to water and sanitation? I think this has, important implication for their, capability and role as a state. Mm.
Okay, thank you. I think there was somebody, yes, the lady just next to you. Yes, thank you.
Hi, thank you for the great presentation. I wanted to ask a little bit about international perception of Vietnam as a communist state, especially in the wake of Fidel Castro's death. Mm. I'm seeing that a lot of Western democracies are still struggling to reconcile between obviously the better things that he did for Cuba versus the more oppressive sides of a socialist state. And so you mentioned a lot about the improvement in governance and human rights Vietnam has made. And I was wondering if, is there a difference in how Vietnam is treated by these donors compared to other neighboring democratic states? Has that changed with these new improvements?
Mm. Okay, maybe two more. Yes, over there. Yes.
Hey, thank you for great presentation, sir. As you mentioned, like the government strategy was highly evaluated by the donors, but is there any possibility that the donor country itself has intervened to make the policy which will be favorable for the donor countries?
Okay, thank you for the question. And then maybe here right in the front.
Hi. I mean, the overarching perspective from the Communist Party's perspective was control. Yeah, you couldn't operate without registration, fitting into the system, all the rest of it. I mean, my impression from this is that they've been staggeringly successful at development. That, they've got everything they wanted. They are still in control. They're still running the country. They've developed. Would you say that's a perception that's shared by the party as well? That they have managed this 30-year process staggeringly well.
Okay. All right.
Okay, the taxes of water and so that's the most crucial issue. So that is deficient at the moment. So fees and taxes are not collected, and that is why the system cannot self-fund itself. So it's that needs to be improved. And of course, I'm sure that people in the government are thinking about that, but it's not a sector that I usually work in. I'm not sure. I mean, it's not decided of how they want to deal with that. So there is still hope that somehow external funding will come in. But you are absolutely right. The crucial issue is taxes, right? But it's also important. It's also very, very difficult. You know that. I mean, paying more for services you got for almost free. Difficult to introduce. You don't want to create unrest and create opposition to towards the regime. International perception of the communist system. I think Cuba has always been a very special case, like North Korea, different. Both are communist, but look at the difference. Cuba is almost idealized at a country which has somehow managed to, where communism somehow worked, right? Where a welfare state was created which worked. I don't know, but it's not, when you look at the remaining communist systems, you basically only have our socialist systems, no matter you want to call them. You only have Cuba, you have North Korea, which is in a league of its own, in a way. Is it really a communist system or what is it actually? But then, and you have China, you have Vietnam, and you have Laos. And I think that China, Vietnam, and Laos are somewhere in the same category because certainly Vietnam and China, because they are not truly communist systems anymore in the economic sense, because there are market economies to some extent, although they are not internationally recognized necessarily as market economies, but they have gone in this direction. There's still one-party states. And this is how Vietnam is seen, as a one-party state, not necessarily in communist terms anymore. Right? And I don't think there has ever been any issue in relations with donors due to the communist nature of the political system. Because what mattered for donors was the development orientation of the government, and of course the clear benefits that were created for the population and all that. So, and anyway, I mean, it's not like, let's say, 30 or 40 or even 20 years ago when we all thought, well, there are different political systems in the world. We have democracies, we have authoritarian systems, and at some point the authoritarian systems will transform and then become consolidated democracies in the end. So we have a lot of mixed systems which have some elements of more liberal features and more autocratic or authoritarian features, or as it's called in political science, we are dealing with a lot of de facto democracies or semi-democracies or semi-authoritarian regimes. So there are many shades of gray, so it's very difficult to tell. So I think we have abandoned the idea that we can divide the world into democracies and authoritarian systems. So a lot of countries are somewhere in between. But of course, as always, there are double standards. So in some cases, political systems matter more than in other cases. And clearly in the case of Vietnam, the strategic importance of Vietnam has worked to the country's advantage. And for the party, yes, the party clearly claims the credit for that. I mean, that is the main basis for legitimacy. It's a successful development process. But as we have seen in previous years, they cannot afford too many mistakes. And the corruption issue is a serious problem that needs to be tackled. And not much progress has been made on that. Also, the further liberalization and privatization process, which got stuck, has to gain new momentum. Because one of the challenges that Vietnam faces is, of course, regionalization and globalization. Of course, we have the ASEAN Economic Community, which is not a proper economic community, but anyway, we have the ASEAN Southeast, the China-ASEAN Free Trade Area, and Vietnam is the single country that loses out most. It has an immense trade deficit with China due to that free trade area. Malaysia, on the other hand, gains the most from that arrangement, but China is the big winner, right? So most, at the moment at least, most ASEAN nations do not really see the clear economic benefits of this free trade area. But Vietnam suffers the most, and there is a lot of pressure on companies to be more competitive, and state-owned companies in Vietnam are simply not competitive. And these are the challenges that the government faces, and they need to be addressed. And they are not being addressed very effectively at the moment.
Okay, I am really afraid that we have run out of time. This was a great talk, Jörn.
Thank you very much, Jörn.
It's a wonderful example of how you do original research based on field work, yeah, in part. And please join me, therefore, in thanking our speaker for his excellent presentation and for him sharing his many insights. Thank you very much for coming as well.
Thank you.